Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Fast Pod. I'm Graham Cleland, and I'm here with my co-host, John Doran. John, how are you?
I'm good. Another busy weekend.
Yeah, what was catching your eyes in terms of headlines? You're the hard-bitten tabloid journalist, so what gossip and scandal from the motorsport world caught your eye over the weekend?
Well, I think the interesting stuff, I mean, Formula One continued its assault on America in Miami. I think it was more of an event than a race. I'm not sure an orchestra introducing the drivers will catch on everywhere. I think probably my highlight of what on the TV was Sir Jackie Stewart barging his way through the security to chat to Roger Federer. The man's a star.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot of first-hand experience of dealing with Sir Jackie over the years, and he's got a certain way about him. But yeah, he is motorsport royalty, so I would not like to be a security guard standing in his way at a Formula One race.
No, and good that he actually got to get to Federer and brought him back. But you looked at the races. I mean, Max Verstappen, Perez, Red Bull did what Red Bull do. And I'm not convinced that Formula One can survive with such domination. I don't know, we said that in the past with Mercedes.
Well, we've had periods of that in the past before and it survived. Is that a bad thing? Everybody has their turn.
It's that's two races in a row with Baku and this one where, you know, so they were pretty much processions in some places.
Yeah, you know me, John. This is where the knives will come out, but some motorsport will hate me saying this, but this is why I'm a fan of reverse grids at every level. And I know that is absolutely, Formula One people will probably be tweeting us and typing and saying that's sacrilege, but actually, I still think you need that to mix it up.
No, I think it'll be good fun. It'll be good fun in places. But speaking of controversy, I mean, it's, but also a big thing this weekend was the British touring cars on at Brands Hatch. And I know you were at the British GT at Silverstone. And I just don't understand from a fan point of view why you have your two biggest series on the same weekend, especially at a time when you're struggling to get marshal numbers.
I totally agree, John. I think there's multiple issues there. And you know, this type of scheduling challenge has been around for a lot of years. I mean, I remember, you know, working in BTCC at times and we were annoyed that there was other big events on at the same time. You've got things like Goodwood quite often happen when you've actually got BTCC and British GT on in the same weekend. And so it's a nightmare for marshalling. It's a nightmare for fans who actually want to watch the race and would pay to go to them if they were on at different times. But it's a nightmare for the teams and drivers from a logistics point of view, because as you know, some of those teams put in entrants in both.
Yeah, I mean, there were teams, obviously, at Brands Hatch that they just had a shadow outfit that, you know, they could only have like half a team there because the rest of them were all up at Silverstone.
Yeah, and it seems mad not to want to maximise your gate, doesn't it, as well? You know, when you've got two events on down south at the same time.
I'm sure there's fans that would have, you know, if they'd got the opportunity, would have gone to one weekend and then the other the following weekend.
Totally agree. Totally agree. It seems madness to have them on. I know it's a very compressed calendar, but, you know, it just seems like common sense that the organisers would want to speak to each other and avoid that wherever possible. And that's before you even factor in things like, you know, could BSB be on the same weekend? Will you have a national rally somewhere? You know, that there's a whole lot of challenges around that type of fixture scheduling. And yeah, anything that can be done to smooth that off would be helpful for everybody involved, I think.
What was the crowd like at Silverstone?
It was good, actually. So I went down on Saturday, although actually I took my son. It was a sort of father and son weekend away, boys weekend. He really wanted to go to the museum at Silverstone. And luckily we did that on a Saturday because it was pouring with rain. Absolutely terrible weather. We did the museum and then we did pop into the paddock for a while. We thought we'd catch quali, which was meant to be on later in the day. And it was a total washout. So I'll be honest, there was nobody in the paddock on Saturday. And the people that were there were cowering under umbrellas. And there wasn't an awful lot happening on track because, frankly, it was a bit dangerous. There was puddles all over the place. So not a bit of a washout. Thankfully, weather improved on Sunday. Glorious weather. Actually quite warm. Sunglasses weather. And it was a good crowd. And actually, do you know, it was probably maybe been a couple of seasons since I was in the British GT paddock, just because of pandemic and all that sort of stuff. But being a regular visitor over the years, and I think they've really polished up the act. You know, I think there was lots going on in the paddock for spectators, even when there wasn't racing happening. You know, the racing's always been good, but I thought there was a lot of good entertainment on. And Silverstone, they really tried to build that up as their sort of blue ribboned event in the calendar. And I thought it reflected that. And I thought, you know, it was, apart from having a great grid, both in the GT and GT4 classes, some really good racing. I thought all round the SRO did a very good, you know, job of promoting it. So yeah, all credit to them. The young man enjoyed it very much.
That's the main thing.
Yeah, it was good racing, drama right to the end. There was a few safety cars which mixed things up. Scots didn't fare all that well over the weekend, if I'm being truly biased. So, Johnny Adam had a tough weekend. Sandy Mitchell looked like he might have been on for the win at one stage, and had it snatched at the end. And a couple of other Scots like Ian Loggie and things like that had unfortunate incidents. So, yeah, guys carrying the salt tire. It didn't quite go for them this weekend when it usually does, but it was objectively a very entertaining race. So, can't complain.
It's good that the racing, you know, that the racing isn't always the main thing, that these series know to make a fan experience, a family experience.
Yeah, totally. And I think SRO, to be fair to them, have really built that up. You know, they've done a very good job of, for example, encouraging supercar owners to come into the paddock and show off their cars. But that's great if you're a paying spectator and you walk in and you get to see a whole bunch of other stuff happening off track as well. And yeah, when the sun shines, it was a very pleasant experience all around. So, but British GT, that brings us nicely to our guest this week. So we have none other than British GT legend and double Le Mans winner, Johnny Adam, who's a fellow Scot. On the show and giving us an interview. And we thought we'd try and do something a little bit different, didn't we? Rather than just asking about, you know, all the stuff that he's won. Everybody knows that.
And he's won a lot.
Yes, he's won a lot over the years. So we're trying to dig a little bit below the surface and ask him some questions about, well, what is it he actually does in the car? What is it that makes him fast? And it was a pretty revealing interview, wasn't it?
Yeah, the passion that he shows is incredible, but his depth of knowledge is pretty stunning. So it was a good chat.
Okay, well, let's get him on and let's have a little listen to what he had to say for himself. Johnny, welcome to the show. Welcome to the Fast Pod. How are you?
Very well. Yeah, very well. Season has started. So, yeah, looking forward to the next couple of races coming up for us.
Started with a win already this season. And what is it with you in this series?
It's a series that's obviously for my Aston career and for my GT career, it's been quite close to my heart, really, because it's where I started in 2011. So, yeah, a couple of weeks ago, I'd done my 100th race, which I don't think many people have got to that milestone. And I've been in and out of the championship for 11, 12 years. And yeah, it was nice on the 100th race that we managed to capture a win. So, I think that was my 17th win. So, and a good way to start the season, to be fair. It's nice to get the ball rolling and always start the season with a win's a nice benefit for the long term.
It was tricky conditions as well. I mean, sort of lays out this myth that when it's raining, the Scots shine. Is it something to do with the weather?
It was one of the probably hardest races I've done over the 100, to be fair, because it was one of those, you know, this year I'm driving a non-Aston for the first time full time in a championship, so I'm learning the car as I go. And the biggest thing when it rained was learning where the wiper was and where all the buttons were to turn things on or off. And then at the same front, when the rain did come, I was sort of the guinea pig being at the front because we were all still on a slick tire and the grip level was just deteriorating so much every lap. So you're sort of you're leading the way, but you're leading the way of where the grip it is and isn't. And it did, it went down to the final corner of the final lap, but it was tricky. The rain was coming in quite heavy for the last lap, and it was literally impossible to even hold it on the road for the last corner. But yeah, it was good. I think everyone enjoyed watching it, which was the main thing. And to be fair, the championship's gone through a massive cycle in the last sort of 3 or 4 years, for a good reason, and it's probably the toughest it's been for a long time with the grid size and the quality of the grid as well. I mean, we've got, you know, Silverstone coming up, which is their big halo race. It's a 3 hour race, and there's, you know, 24 GT3 cars and a grid size altogether of 42 cars. So it's something they've not had in a long time like that. So yeah, nice to start the season well. So we'll see how it all pans out.
Johnny, can I ask you a quick question? Just a point you made there about leading from the front in a race like that. And, you know, when you've not necessarily got a marker in front of you to measure yourself against. And I guess this is something I haven't seen you race over the years. I'm interested in, some drivers seem to fare better when they've got, you know, somebody in front of them, you know, they're making their way through traffic. And you kind of know that if they're in the top two or three with a few laps to go, they're probably in a good shape to challenge for the win. But maybe struggle if they're sitting out there at the front, having to put in, you know, fastest lap after fastest lap and control it. But you seem quite comfortable in that zone, and maybe even more comfortable in a race like that, where you can get out ahead and kind of control it. Is that true, or is that a fair reflection? Is that how you feel? I'm just interested in your approach to that.
Yeah, I mean, some drivers are quite different in their mindset, really, more than anything. I've seen drivers in the past and coach drivers that, you know, they can't really lead a race. They could come from fifth or sixth on the grid and they can get to the front, but they stall in terms of pace or what to do because there's no carrot in front. But I've, you know, over the years in the one make stuff that I've done with Clio's and with the State Cooper Championship, qualifying made or breaks your weekend, really. So leading from the front was something that I really had to do back then. And I actually like the pressure. That's the big thing about leading from the front, is you know you have to be inch perfect. The lap time has to be cleaned every single lap. And, you know, you're chased, you know, so you have that, you know, pressure behind. So I do, you know, I do genuinely like to get to the front and know that there is pressure on to try and pull a gap or maintain that gap. And it's, you know, I think it's not looking too much in your mirrors as well. So many drivers sort of constantly look in their mirrors and they're more worried about traffic behind or any, you know, anyone catching that. The distraction comes and then the mistakes happen. But I just try and zone out of that and just try and really focus on what's coming up on my dash in terms of a lap time, and really just trying to focus on not making, you know, making, if it was a 20 lap race, making 20 perfect laps, not just 10 fast laps and 10 very average laps, you know. And that's what, you know, when it comes to sports cars, mostly for the longer distance races, I mean, nowadays there is no real sprint racing, they're all, you know, an hour to 24 hours long, you know. But, you know, for example, at Le Mans, you're doing, you know, 3 hours, for example. You could be doing a triple stint during the night or just over. And all we look at is an average. All the teams, they want to see is an average lap time from the driver that's strong. And that might be, you know, stuff like not looking at too much of taking the tire, you know, as in taking too much out of the new tire at the start of your stint, which could be a quite a negative as the stint goes on, especially circuits like Barcelona, where the tire dead could be like 2 seconds a lap at the end of the race. So consistency is massive. And that's why I like leading from the front, because I know if I could drive the 20 or however many perfect laps, then I know I've done my bit. And if the car's quick enough and I could just be fast enough, the result will hopefully come, you know.
So you look at your performance, and obviously you've got a teammate in a GT car. How much do you think that you can teach them, and how much does it have to be natural talent?
There has to be a bit of natural talent. You know, over the years, like with, especially with Aston, you know, I've won the British GT Championship with four different individuals, and they are completely four different individuals. And, you know, if you all had them in one room, they are so different in terms of personality, what they need to, what gets them to tick in terms of what gets them to get that lap time, you know. And you try and, you know, these people are successful in business or have, you know, or have raced a long time or a short time. So you need to sort of work with early on in that relationship to know what you need to get out of them. And I think a lot of that comes down, a little bit of experience makes a big difference with that, and age as well, you know. I think over the years I've definitely improved with that, known, you know, I'm racing with customers that are in their 50s and are successful people away from the circuit. We're running big businesses with a lot of people below them. So trying to sort of teach them in the right method and get them to listen is quite important. But I have to say, like, you know, I always put a radio on, so I always put a headset on. I always look at data with them. I always, you know, coach them on the radio, coach them off the track in terms of any simulator preparation that we do. Because for me, you know, in sports cars, especially GT racing, we have a thing called balance of performance, which is there as a regulation to make sure all the cars run at a similar pace. So you can have a McLaren, an Aston, a Mercedes, a Ferrari. You know, there's a list of 10 or 11 manufacturers, and they all want them to do a similar lap time. Now, in my head, balanced performance is all about my teammate, because if I could find them on a weekend 6 or 7 tenths in pure confidence and pure performance, but I maybe have to sacrifice one or two, well, overall, in the grand scheme of those averages that we're talking about, they're going to be better across the board. And more importantly, they're going to give us that ultimate result come Sunday afternoon or Saturday afternoon, whenever the race is. So that's where I really home in. And it's something, you know, I've taken pride in over the years. And it literally goes back into the days of me coaching in a Clio, coaching in a Ginetta Junior, which back then it was fun. Looking back on it, it looked like it felt quite dangerous at times. And also it goes back to just sitting in with customers driving around Knockhill, you know. And it's the way and the means that you have to get your point across, but in a quite a constructive way that they can absorb that, take it, put it into practice, and hopefully improve. And I still do it to this day. I get more excitement sometimes from them doing a good job and a lap time than me actually doing it, if that makes sense, because I know I've put so much into what they are trying to achieve, and when they achieve it, they are so happy, you know, and they might want to continue for another year, do another test day, buy another set of tires, add a program. It's all about the customer for me, you know, and that's obviously been a big thing for Aston and a big thing over the years, you know.
It's quite interesting that point you make, Johnny, about, you know, you were doing sort of coaching in the very early days before your career took off in a big way necessarily as a driver as well. Do you think that's made a difference to your approach and your success over years? Like, do you think, you know, you'd have been a different driver had you not had that coaching experience early on, and you might have been a bit more focused on yourself and maybe not as aware of what you have to do to improve a driver in GT racing that you might be partnering with? Does it change your perspective?
100%. Like, there's two pros really for me. There's pro pros that only want to race with other pros, and they race in America, they race, you know, in GT World Challenge, which is a big GT championship in Europe, but they'll only focus on their own performance, you know, and they'll take their teammates' sort of data if they need it to fully focus on their performance all the time. And don't get me wrong, you know, there's times where I still do that. You know, if there's a teammate car in the team, I'll always look at every data possible, because I'll never stop learning, and I never stop learning every year. I always aim to improve and want to improve. But the big thing for me is I'm a pro. You know, I get it, and I know for me a championship is won or lost for their performance, you know. And there's two people or three people that stand on those podiums. So for me, getting the whole package to work, and that could be down to how the run plan is sort of written out for practice or qualifying of what is needed to get their confidence high. Because if you get a customer that's brimmed high on confidence and they're driving well, your weekend could be quite a successful weekend. If they're pretty low on self-confidence when it comes to not feeling it in terms of the circuit they're at, not feeling it when it comes to the weather they've got, or even the setup. And the big thing with setup is I always try and cater for who I race for. So if I race for a customer that's got very low confidence and wants a car that's pretty safe, shall we say, I'll sacrifice my wants or needs in the car setup to make sure they get what they want. Because ultimately, if I could pick up more lap time from them than myself with that, that's where the longer term goal is. But yeah, I mean, I've coached over the years quite a few drivers. Nicholas Hamilton back in Renault Clios in 2008 and 2009. His sort of first foray into sort of car racing was then. And then Jamie Chadwick and Ginetta Juniors for a year and a half. And some single-seater guys, some Clio guys over the years, quite a few drivers. But to be honest, I don't do as much now because it became quite different when I signed a contract with Aston in 2012, and they didn't really want me to, you know, have the risk of doing testing or track day stuff during the week with customers, because ultimately, you know, being a professionally contracted driver, that was first and foremost. But I still use those disciplines, those procedures to this day, you know, with whoever I drive with.
Is there anybody that you've coached that has really, really impressed you, the way that they've taken it on and sort of actually surprised you at how good they've become?
Jamie was very good. Jamie Chadwick, I think I got the work through her former driver coach, Chris Hodgetts, who still looks after quite an array of Ginetta Junior drivers and Porsche Carrera Cup drivers. And when Jamie, I think she was 13 or 14, and she was very mature for her age in terms of her driving style, her feedback in terms of what she wanted from the car, her data, how she would go about looking at data. So that was, for me, technically, she was very, very good, even at that age. And it, to be fair, I knew she could go quite a long way with her attitude within the sport, her profile, and more her determination and her professionalism on and off the track was refreshing, really, at that age. And, you know, when she became, you know, when she was sort of 15, nearly 16, you know, she could have possibly maybe done another year in Ginetta Juniors, but I pushed hard with her and her family to try and lure her into getting into a GT car. And she'd done a test day with an Aston with Beach Dean Motorsport back then. I think it was 2015. And she went on to become, at that point, one of the youngest champions ever in GT4. She raced with Ross Gunn that year. And she just excelled because she was clever. She knew what she needed to do. She was very smooth and consistent. So GT racing for her then was very, very, you know, our discipline was perfect for that. So it was refreshing to see a pupil that listened, got what she needed to get out of it, was clearly good, but wanted to make the transition even at a young age like she did into GT racing. And she excelled in year one. And now obviously she's gone on to win, was it three Formula W Series championships. And now obviously doing stuff in the States. So yeah, bags of talent, but more refreshingly got the charisma and the professionalism to go a long way in the sport, you know.
We'll not ask you, Johnny, who's the people that scared you the most. Yeah. we'll ask you that over a beer sometime, okay? And you can tell
I'll
us that. We'll not do it on the show. But one question I was going to ask you there, but so that's somebody who's, you know, you've coached and they've taken on board what you've said and they've made you know, a big improvement, etc. But I guess if there was somebody coming in new to the sport, at whatever level, either for they're young or they're a bit older and they're coming into racing, you know, is there one thing that you would give them as a piece of advice to focus on that you think would help anybody's improvements in racing?
You can't beat practice. That's the big thing. The amount of people that come in and maybe go a level too high and they can't stretch that budget to do the testing or the, you know, put the correct tires on the car at the correct time. And they're just racing at maybe a level they want to race at, but financially or maybe even the level they're at, it's just a stretch too far. And I always say you're better to win at a level you can do properly. And that's just for the greater good in terms of, you know, if you can test, you know, 5-10 times a year rather than not testing at all, you're going to be in a totally different bracket when it comes to a lap time because you can't beat seat time. So much so, even in the winter, you know, I will get myself back in a go-kart purely on a fitness side and a fun side, but I can't not drive something for more than, you know, 3-4 weeks. You know, it kills me. And I do it to keep sharp, and I do it just to keep, you know, the muscle memory, keep, you know, the racecraft or my brain thinking about what I need to be doing, you know. So, you know, for anyone that is starting out, you can't beat the seat time. And to be fair, you know, nowadays, simulators, home simulators are great. You know, I've got one myself and I still use a simulator for coaching, and they're becoming quite realistic in terms of a technique and what you need to do. But you can't beat the real thing in terms of getting your bum in a seat and feeling everything through a tire, from your feet to your hands to the bumps on the road. So the big thing for me is doing it at the correct level is massively important, you know.
And when you get in a car and you stop yourself being competitive, or do you just get race head on straight away?
Race head straight on out, you know. I only do two or three days a year, and I'm sore after it, to be fair, because you don't use the muscles you use in a car to what you do in a go-kart, but it's good. And to be fair, over the years, I've taken a few of my customers within GT racing there, because there's stuff you can learn even on a go-kart track in terms of, if it rained, you know, the wet line, getting off the rubber, looking for the wet line. And it's just seat time. And as I say, it's just all about muscle memory in terms of a bit of sort of racecraft. But it's good fun. I do it when it's freezing cold, so I can't last long in the car. I get really sore and really cold, but it's all good in preparation for the season ahead. And stuff like, if I've never been to a circuit before, I will always go on a sim for at least 2 or 3 hours to learn everything that I can. And I'll do my homework. I'll always do a track walk. I'll always try and get a customer to do a track walk, because there's stuff that changes. A circuit can change a curb, a bit of tarmac, a runoff, a gravel trap, anything. And you know, it's a job to me. And with Aston, it's an important job, and it is my job to excel and make sure the customer excels on a weekend. So doing the preparation is massive. And I think that's where a lot of people don't maybe put the effort in, is you do have to put the homework in behind the scenes before you get to the circuit, you know, especially when you're racing with someone else, you know, because you want to cover all the bases before you get there, you know. So it does work. You know, when you do that, it's, you know, peace of mind that you've covered those before you even get your bum in the seat come a Thursday or Friday test, you know.
That's a fascinating insight into sort of the approach and preparation, and that balance between, you know, doing your homework and just relying on your talent, you know. And I think, you know, you can see parallels with lots of other sports and things like that. So listen, you've won stuff, okay? And that's well documented, and you're still out there and you're still breaking records and things like that as well. But you're obviously still hungry, and you're doing your work in the off season and things like that too. But, you know, you're quite a cool, calm and collected customer. But do you ever get angry in the car when, during a race? You know, GT racing is usually, you know, pretty gentlemanly in some respects compared to other seas. But, you know, do you ever actually get wound up? Because you don't show it very often.
No, I do, to be fair, I do inside. I don't really show it out the car because you can't. I can't be shouting around, pointing fingers.
Lots of drivers do. I used to get drivers coming out of the car with steam coming out of their ears.
Yeah, a lot do. And to be fair, more sometimes the younger generation do it as well. But, you know, you have to toe the line, you know, especially when you represent a manufacturer, you know, you have to toe the line and do the right thing. But yeah, no, I do, you know, sometimes I get angry, sometimes at myself, you know, if I'm on a lap and I make a mistake, or you're on a lap and it goes red flag because of a car stopping or a spin for somebody, and you're, you know, whether it's a qualifying situation, you know, you get angry. And to be fair, you know, sometimes it helps me. Sometimes if I am a bit angry, because I am quite chilled off the track, and I'm pretty chilled in the car, but a little bit anger inside is sometimes a good thing for me. Don't get me wrong, I'll still drive flat out whether I'm chilled or angry, but a bit of angry just, yeah, gets me a bit more, you know, upbeat of what I need to try and do, you know. But, you know, things do change quite a lot over a race, you know, especially when you're doing endurance stuff. You know, a circuit can change massively, places like Le Mans. You know, you can arrive, you know, on the Wednesday, and the track could be like 4 seconds faster come Saturday night or Sunday morning, you know. So, you know, you have to, when you're driving, you have to really alter a lot of things, you know, all the time. So I think, you know, a big thing for me is concentration is huge, you know, and that's where seat time is great, but the concentration thing with practice is just massive. And I see it a lot in GT racing. You know, there's guys, you know, I'm racing, you know, something different in British GT this year, and the guys that I'm racing against, they're in a car 25 weekends a year, 30 weekends a year. They're so fast, you know, out the box, because they know what they're driving, they know the tire, they know the grip, you know where the limit is straight away from the offset. So, you know, and I do enjoy, the more I race, the more, you know, the more weekends I could do, I feel I'm better with it, you know. And there's a point where sometimes, you know, maybe you could do too much testing if it's too close together and you're not learning too much. And there's drivers, you know, you'll still hear drivers even in the F1 level, I had to sleep on it, you know, in terms of take all the information, process it, sleep, think about it, and then obviously try and execute the following day. So, you know, every day is different, especially at a weekend. And there's weekends I've gone through that I've really, I don't know, I've been on the back foot and I've really struggled, and I've analysed it and overanalyzed it too much. And I've come back the next day, just completely like start again. This is what I need to achieve. This is what I was doing wrong, and just put it right. But I think some people can sort of drag that out for a weekend or two later, you know, by getting down the wrong path, whether it's setup, technique, or, you know, a style within driving, you know.
So you listen to what you're saying about balance of performance and concentration, seat time and everything. Do you have a preference for the longer races, or is it just a race?
No, it's just a race. Yeah, these races nowadays, every race, whether it's Daytona, Nürburgring, Le Mans, you know, they're 24 hours of sprint racing, because the cars are so sophisticated nowadays, especially the GT3 cars, that they're so reliable. So there's no, you know, gone of the days of nursing a car home with 10 hours to go, you know, or anything like that. They're built to last. Hence why manufacturers now test not just for 24 hours to sign a car off, they'll do a 36-hour test, you know, to sign a car off. So yeah, you're literally flat out, you know, you're doing 24 hours of qualifying, basically. But at the same time, traffic management is massive in terms of, you know, even at a level like British GT, for example, we are the top class in that with GT3, and we're overtaking the slower car, GT4, for example, Oulton Park. You know, you could be overtaken at least two or three cars a lap minimum on average, you know. So you have to take risk because it's a narrow circuit and you have to get by quickly, because if you don't, the guy behind or the two guys behind might get by, but it has to be calculated and it has to be respectful. And again, a bit of experience, I've seen guys in the past make mistakes because they are a bit too aggressive in traffic. So there's that fine line between, I always say to the customer, it has to be a controlled aggression, you know, controlled enough that you know where you need to place the car and the car in front knows where you need to place the car, but it's done at a point that you can get past as quickly as you can. And that is another element away, which is great for GT racing, because it's not just about a clear run at it. You have to have this outer sort of preparation in terms of race experience and race craft, along with pure speed as well, you know.
You've set this one up because you mentioned three races there, three 24 hour races, all really, really good races. Nürburgring, Daytona and Le Mans. They've all got their own different sort of characteristics, but yep. Which one do you reckon is the best?
There's three completely different three completely different circuits, obviously, but three completely different atmospheres as well. And I'd say the halo one is Le Mans for sure, because of what it is. And every driver, I think, that's within the sport, whether even they're at F1, will potentially want to do Le Mans. It's, you know, it's steeped in history. It's an awesome circuit. And it's, you know, it's hard fought. You know, all the manufacturers want to win it, even in the GT class. And you know, I'm very fortunate. I've done it five times and won it twice, and I'm desperate to get back there. You know, I'm so hungry to get back there in the future, in the near future. Daytona's cool because it's early on in the season. It's a January race. It's so cool the way IMSA do it, because they have wave buys, so you can have an issue with the car potentially, or you know, somebody makes a mistake, and you could literally be two or three laps down, and you think, okay, we're out with this. But actually, with their regulations, if you land lucky, you could get a wave buys and get back onto the lead lap. So the way they have it is quite a spectacle, the last hour of a Daytona 24-hour race, because it is a sprint finish, you know. And you don't get that at Le Mans. You don't get that anywhere else. But they have written those regulations really cleverly for that. And Nürburgring's just absolutely crazy in terms of a circuit, spectators. It's just massive risk and huge reward when you do get a clear lap, or when you do actually get to the finish of that race. Because, you know, if you look at it over the years, manufacturers like Mercedes, Audi, Porsche, they don't take one car, they take 6 to 8 cars, you know, because they know, we talked about traffic management, it's massive around there, because you've got potentially nearly 200 cars doing that race. And the gulf in speed between the top class, the GT3 class, to the slower class, or the slowest class, could be minutes of a lap time. So the closing speeds are huge. So there is risk, massive risk around there. But it's a cool place. It's a circuit that is one of the best in the world. It's amazing. It's got everything there. It's a long lap. It takes a lot of, you know, commitment to do a good lap time around there. But it's, you know, it's the big one for the German manufacturers to be represented at. And it's something I've done two or three times, a 24-hour race there with Aston. And I do miss it massively as well, because it's such an awesome, iconic circuit that even in a road car that you could pay whatever it is, 10, 15 euros to do a lap round, it's pretty special, you know.
Thanks, Johnny. That is a brilliant insight into, you know, your approach to racing in general, but also, you know, GT racing at a top level, and also where the rest of us might improve if we're looking to drive quicker at whatever level we're competing at and starting out at. So, yeah, listen, thanks for coming on the Fast Pod, taking time out of your busy schedule. You know, you've got a race to prepare for this weekend. Yeah, so thanks again. Best luck for the rest of the season.
Mega. Thank you, guys. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Johnny.
Cheers.
24-hour racing, that was pretty controversial, that he thinks Le Mans the best one. I'm not sure that everybody listening would totally agree, so hopefully they'll let us know about that.
Yeah, I thought there was a lot of interesting little nuggets in there, wasn't there? You know, he's an interesting character. He's clearly, you know, he's a serial winner, right? But what I thought was interesting was trying to get him to articulate how does he bring people with him, you know, when he's partnering people that might not have the same level of experience. And he gave away quite a lot of detail about that, didn't he?
It's just the great idea that he has a week or two without being in a car and he starts getting itchy.
I know. I guess, though, I suppose that's like any great sportsman, isn't it? Like, how do you keep your muscle memory sharp? And it was interesting that he said it was karts and not, you know, going banging around a racetrack somewhere. I'm sure he's got access to whatever type of car he wants to test in at that level. But yeah, it was interesting. He just has to drive something.
And also the fact that, you know, the top sportsmen, they're interested in themselves. And yet he's not. He wants other people to do well.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing, you know, having, you know, known Johnny for a fair while and seen him driving different categories. I remember, so this is going way back, but I first encountered him in touring cars and kind of knew all of them, but didn't know him when he was sort of coming up through the ranks. And he was winning a lot of stuff, you know, in Clio's, and you saw him around the paddock, and then he, you know, won the Sea at Leon series. So, you know, he clearly had a bit about him. And then he came to work in the touring car team that I was with at the time, Motorbase, and nobody really knew much about him, you know, as a person. But it was clear from the off that he was a very cool customer. And in his first weekend, there was a lot of focus on him. But the team won a couple of races. And at that time, you know, Motorbase was kind of up and coming and hadn't won that many, but they were starting to be a sort of rising force. And Johnny just was so cool about the whole thing, and the team were really buzzing about winning. You know, it was like a football team winning a football match, the excitement in the garage at the time. And he's just like not bothered, not fussed, because he was just so used to winning. He's just very, very calm all the time. So it was rare that you saw him flustered, whereas other drivers, you know, would get out, punch the air, hug their, you know, mechanic. And he just never really has gone in for that sort of stuff. He's quite a cool customer.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've reported on him since he was in the Sayers. And even when he won there and he knew how much it meant to him because he needed the budget and that sort of thing, he was still such a cool customer, and that really came across.
Yeah, I think also, though, it's interesting, isn't it? So you've got something like that who's been successful over a long period, and you kind of wonder, well, how do they stay hungry? How do they stay sharp? You know, and what actually motivates them? So, you know, if you've gone and won all these big races, etc., what keeps you coming back and keeps you at it? But it's clear that he just likes driving. You know, that's what actually motivates him, and that he would probably drive anything. Okay, hope you enjoyed that, everybody. You can find us on www.fastpod.com. You can get us on all the good social medias like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Send us your questions. Send us your requests for who you'd like us to interview the next time. And hit that subscribe button. Make sure you follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Thanks for listening. And tune in next time when we'll have another top guest with some real insight into the sport.